Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us today. On behalf of John Hamry, the President and CEO of CSIS, and Sam Nunn, our Chairman, I welcome you to this, the third in a series of discussions with our service secretaries. We've had Secretary Guerin here a month ago. We had Secretary Donnelly here last week. And today we have the honor of Dr. Donald C. Winter, the 74th Secretary of the Navy. I think that's only because Gordon England was 72 and 73, so he's really the 73rd Secretary. Several months ago, I sat down with John Hamry. We were discussing the importance of service secretaries, especially from their Title X responsibilities, organize, train, and equip. As many as you know, oftentimes service secretaries sort of get subsumed in that cloud that surrounds the Secretary of Defense because he sucks all the oxygen out of the room. And the guys who have to actually supply the weapon systems, research them, buy them, and maintain them, there is John Hamry in the back. Mr. President, how are you? The three service secretaries have that burden shared with, as we call them, the level two group, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics, and the Secretaries of the Army, Navy, and the Air Force. Don Winter came to the Pentagon in January of next year. It'll be 3 years ago. I was there at the time, welcomed him, and to a group of individuals who even in peacetime have, as I've indicated, a responsibility that is unlike any other. There is no prep course for holding one of these senior positions. And last night at the Cowboys-Redskins game, which unfortunately my team lost, there was considerable discussion in among the group of us who were watching the game as to the next group of leaders in the Pentagon, and the important issues and the important challenges that remain in front of them. Don Winter came to us from industry by design. I was the chairman of the Executive Search Committee for the Secretary of Defense, and we had a specific set of criteria that we were looking for in individuals who would fulfill the roles at the level two level. Don had been president of Northrop Grumman's Mission Systems Sector. And prior to that, he was president and CEO of TRW Systems. But he wasn't an unknown commodity to those of us in the defense community. Neither was he unschooled in the ways of the Department of Defense, having spent several years at the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency under the fellow Dr. Bob Cooper, who I remember, who was running the Strategic Defense Initiative. And I think you were specifically involved with the Talon Gold program. For some of you out there, you might remember that. University of Michigan, physicist, PhD, and a member of the National Academy of Engineering. Again, we are honored to have you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Ray. It's good to be here, and it's good to be able to try to recap a little bit of what's been transpiring over the last 3 years and some of the things that I've been, quite frankly, trying to deal with during this period of time. And as I've been trying to look back over that period of my life and trying to put things into place and trying to connect the dots, if you will, one of the things that I found to be helpful is to take a look at what's transpired and the types of issues that I've dealt with and try to look at them from a thematic perspective, if you will. And one of the thematic perspectives that I found is kind of useful and that I'd like to discuss today has to do with the appropriate role for contractors with the military. And this is something that goes through a broad spectrum, if you would, of activities. Everything from the discussions, the arguments, if you will, associated with the appropriateness and proper roles for contractors on the battlefield, all the way through the rigorous aspects associated with the whole acquisition process. for those who will suggest that contractors are never appropriately involved in direct operational support, that the role of the military is really reserved just for those in uniform, I will refer you back to our Constitution and the Constitution's discussions associated with the issuance of letters of marque, because the concept, if you will, of privateers and the role of privateers in terms of military activities and in terms of the defense of our nation really goes back to the 18th century and those early days where, in fact, privateers were a major part of the naval capability that the U.S. Provided. It's not just been a matter, if you will, of at-sea activities. I can identify several land-based Army support activities. Frontiersmen like Daniel Boone, Native Americans like Sacagawea, all were involved as guides, as interpreters and translators, if you will, for our military back in the early days of the foundation of our country. So this is something that is not new. Perhaps what is new is the way in which this concept has evolved over the last several years. And there have been a number of areas that have changed in a very significant way over that time period. First of all, if you go back perhaps to World War II days, where the concept of contractors in rear area doing maintenance, heavy maintenance efforts was kind of the mainstay, to where we are today, there's been some obvious changes. First and foremost, perhaps, is the fact that it's very hard in many areas to define what the rear area is, especially when one is dealing with counterinsurgency operations. Rear area does not mean quite the same thing that it did during World War II or in World War I and other engagements back then. Perhaps equally important is the fact that we now have contractors providing technical support, not only for maintenance activities, but for operations and operations support. And I will stipulate that in my former life, as Ray described it, where I used to provide support to operational forces, we in fact had personnel on the battlefield in Desert Storm and other activities in the Balkans who were providing, if you will, software support and other capabilities as part of Blue Force tracking and other advanced technologies that were being provided to the military. It was necessary. It was not just a matter of fixing broke equipment, but it was a matter of helping the forces adopt and use some of the most capable advanced technologies. Similar type of approach that was used in the employment of JSTARS and other surveillance assets that have been used of late, where contractors were a major part of the operational support of those activities. Not quite just the way it used to be in World War II and previous engagements in terms of the rear area support. And all of that, I think, is very much a part of the leverage that we find for technology today and the technological capabilities that we're trying to employ on the very front lines. That's the first issue. Second issue that's changed very significantly, I will suggest, over the last several years, is the fact that the nature of today's military makes it very difficult to surge the way we used to in the past. If you take a look at what transpired in World War II in terms of the way in which we're able to rapidly grow our force, both in terms of personnel and in terms of some of the major platforms, the shipbuilding activities, the aircraft construction activities, land vehicles and the like, a tremendous surge. It doesn't work that way anymore. It's very, very difficult. And it's not just a matter of having a volunteer force as opposed to a conscripted force. But again, it has a lot to do with the nature of combat and the use of technology. Even if you go and take a look at the basic training functions that we have nowadays, the basic training that a Marine is provided before they're part of the Fleet Marines has gone up by a factor of 2.5 in the intervening years. the technologies that we have to train those who are involved in our more sophisticated systems, be they combat systems on board a ship or aircraft operations or the like, go into even more extensive training requirements. This makes it very, very difficult to be able to surge in a very short time period. One way of augmenting our capabilities, one way of surging, if you will, is to engage contractors to provide some of that technical support in a direct way as opposed to having to train military personnel, uniformed personnel. Also, it is a mechanism, if you will, of tapping, in many cases, the retiree population for training activities. Again, one of the things we've seen here of late is the value of being able to tap into a retiree community that very much wants to stay engaged, that very much wants to be able to support the ongoing efforts, and that is willing and able to engage in a variety of training efforts directly with the new military personnel, avoiding having to go through that cycle of training the trainer and then having the trainer train the force. So that's issue number two. The third item that I would bring up has to do with just simply the nature of the volunteer force. We have a wonderful military these days to a great extent because they are all volunteers. They want to do what they're doing. They know full well the risks and are more than willing to take on those challenges. That said, they do not volunteer to do the laundry. They did not volunteer to enlist in the military because they want to clean latrines. We cannot treat them the way we did the conscripts in World War II and or Korea. And so it is sometimes both appropriate and necessary to be able to use contractors to support many of these activities. So you get into the question of, okay, what is it that really draws the boundary lines? What is it that constrains the service in terms of how and where it should use civilian personnel and in particular contractors? And I would say that when you go and take a look at all of the decisions that we've made, perhaps the most significant formative consideration that we've given in terms of the appropriate role for contractors has to do with maintaining the expeditionary nature of our services. Having a Marine Corps and having a Navy which is capable of operating in an expeditionary manner without infrastructure being in place ahead of time is absolutely critical. It is part of what defines and I would suggest differentiates our services. And we continue to do it. Everything from the basic concept of a Marine Expeditionary Unit all the way up through and including CB operations. I have to tell you, it's been absolutely fascinating on many of my trips to theater to be able to go out and see what our CBs will be doing out in the middle of nowhere with virtually no support and very little definition of what has to be done. And they will go ahead and they will have the mission done. They can do, and they can do whatever needs to take place with very, very limited support, a unique capability that, again, provides a lot of value. That said, we can and we will use contractors when it is either appropriate or where it is necessary to support our operations and our objectives. It is sometimes appropriate when we have major bases to be able to have contractors providing us with support services, quality of life services, a dining facility, clean latrines and laundry facilities, things of that nature, where we're not talking about forward operating bases. That helps in terms of the overall quality of life for our deployed sailors and Marines, and I think is very appropriately provided. There are cases where it is truly necessary. Interpreters and translators were as important in the days of Sacagawea as they are today. We need to have individuals who not only can converse in the various languages of the communities that we're engaged in, but in counterinsurgency operations, we need to be able to interpret what is being said in a culturally appropriate way. We need to have people who understand what the intent is and what the signs are not just verbally but physically, whether people are dressed appropriately, whether they're in the right place, whether they're behaving in the right way, or whether we ought to be noting their behavior and their presence in a different way. Interpreters and translators often come from the host or deployed country, and they will continue to be a critical asset for us. Lastly, and I don't mean this to be an inclusive list, but there will continue to be cases where technology differentiation needs to be supported, and in some cases provided by contractors. I don't like it. I'll be real blunt. I don't like the fact that I can go out to forward operating bases and find contractors there operating ISR assets like the Scan Eagle system past the normal areas of safety for contractors. Nonetheless, that is the only way that we can get capabilities like this at this point in time. But we have, as a result of recognizing the criticality of these assets, pushed very hard to be able to convert programs like Scan Eagle to programs of record so that we can acquire the assets into the inventory and train uniformed personnel on their operation so that we can transition from a contracted service to a military capability. Now, that brings me to the whole issue, if you will, of acquisition, and I know a lot of effort and interest goes on relative to acquisition and what the best way is of doing acquisition. I will suggest that when I look at acquisition, I refer to acquisition as the total scope of acquiring the capabilities that define our fleet. And by fleet, I don't mean just ships, but the ships, the aircraft, the land vehicles, everything that defines our naval capabilities for the future. And, oh, by the way, I believe very strongly that only the services, only in our case the Navy and the Marine Corps, are really in a position to define the fleet of the future. Our fleet defines so much of what the services are. It's not just a matter of the equipment that we provide to our Marines and sailors, but it is where we live. It defines our ability to retain our personnel. It defines the training that we have to provide to our personnel. It defines the needs of our shore facilities. It defines the way in which we fight and the way in which we're able to conduct operations in times other than war. And it's a total spectrum that really needs the involvement and engagement of the entirety of the Navy and the Marine Corps. Now, only industry is postured to be able to provide us with the tools that we use, with the ships, with the airplanes, with the land vehicles. And the process of procuring those individual items is a part of the whole acquisition process. But it needs to be in response to a clear understanding of what is needed to evolve the fleet. One point I should make is that when we look at this from a naval perspective, we are in a continuing evolutionary process of modernizing the fleet. We have several hundred ships. We have hundreds of aircraft and land vehicles. And it is not just a matter of turning over from one type model series to another type model series. It is a matter of taking on new assets on a continuing basis and continually evolving our capabilities. It will take many years, in part because of the lifetime of these systems. And it impacts everything that we do. So we need to make sure that our ability to maintain operations, to support the various engagements, continues and, in fact, is continuously enhanced as we go through that evolutionary process. One way of ensuring that we get the intended results out of that long-term investment is to ensure that we look at this from a systems perspective. We talk about this often as the systems engineering, if you will, of our capability of the future. It is an approach which provides us with the integration of all the factors, all the considerations that are needed, and hopefully, if done right, will provide us with proper, detailed and stable specifications and standards for procurement that can be used by industry to produce the items that we're interested in acquiring and that we're interested in using to be able to modernize our system. Now, in that regard, we get into the question of how do you do your procurement in such a way as to most effectively leverage industry? And I will say that in that area, we have sometimes done well and sometimes have not done as well as I would have liked. I will suggest that one example where we've been able to leverage industry, leverage the capabilities of the industrial base at large, is on the MRAP program, the Mine Resistance Ambush Protected Vehicles that we have been acquiring to support our personnel in Iraq and Afghanistan. It has been, I think, a very good case study of where we've been able to leverage the industrial base and the infrastructure that has existed. We've been able to adapt products, truck products, components, and the like, to a very unique purpose that has served our military well. And we've been able to leverage many of the personnel that come from that industry who have been assigned to this particular problem by the corporations. A good way of leveraging and getting value out of the overall industrial base. Shipbuilding, I have to say, has been a much more difficult challenge. And shipbuilding perhaps is unique in terms of acquisitions within the DOD. It is truly a case of a monopsony, if you will, a case in which there is only one real buyer, that's the U.S. Navy, for a product. And in fact, if one takes a look at the six principal yards that provide the vast majority of the ships that our Navy buys, with the exception of a small level of production for the Coast Guard and a few Jones Act ships from one of those six yards, those yards are effectively totally dependent on the Navy for their sales. And the question is whether or not Navy is able to get what it needs out of that process and whether or not we're able to get the leverage that we should be able to get from a monopsony. And again, I'm reminded from my perhaps misspent youth in industry of the way in which commercial primes are often able to get very good performance from those who work for them, and watching how companies like Ford and GM were able to leverage their parts suppliers like TRW to reduce their price, notwithstanding the existence of ongoing contracts, just because they needed to be more cost effective, kind of reminds you that in a commercial world, things can get very tough, and people, in particular buyers that have a lot of leverage, are able to get what they need. Now, that is a question, is what is it that's really needed? And in the automotive industry, a lot of pressure was on cost, but also there was a lot of pressure on quality. And one of the reasons that there was a pressure on quality had to do with the liabilities associated, both in terms of the strict liability associated with accidents and the like, but also the liabilities associated with product recall. Navy has a significant concern and issue associated with quality as well. I mean, in the end, what Navy really wants in terms of its products is a quality item that is provided at a predictable delivery and a predictable cost. And quality is perhaps the overriding consideration. And it's a very difficult consideration to both evaluate and demand. I will suggest that what we have right now is not as good as I would like. I would like to suggest that we really need the institution of a quality culture within the entirety of the industrial base. And by the way, that includes the Navy part that interfaces with the industrial base. And quality culture, by the way, is more than just an issue of defects and specific items that may come up in production and inspection. It has to do with the totality of the entire development and production process. It starts out with a good quality design, a design that has margin and capability to deal with unforeseen issues, whether that has to do with variations in production or variations in use and operations. But a good, robust design provides a good basis for the start. And then you get into the questions of workmanship, and not just at the final item, but workmanship at each individual level. I have to tell you that I was really impressed a few months ago when I was over visiting some of the Korean shipyards to see and observe the way in which they work in quality at every individual level of build and integration, a level at which I wish we could emulate in many aspects. There are the issues of fully testing and characterizing the products and providing the logistical support. And in the end, there is the total spectrum of efforts to provide a fact-based control system on the entire process, which ensures that you have a quality product at the end. And by the way, this is important not because I'm worried about warranty costs or what it takes to repair an item that fails or what have you. The biggest issue for the Navy is the challenge that can occur should something fail at the wrong time. Should it fail and put sailors or Marines at risk? Should it fail and preclude operations for sailors or Marines? These are things that we cannot really quantify in terms of their costs, but they are opportunity costs, and they are very significant and of great concern. I think we need to do a number of things to try to improve, to be able to get closer to a quality culture. I think we need to enhance the domain knowledge within the management channels, both within Navy and within the industrial base. I think we need to improve requirements and design discipline. I think we need to reduce the very high turnover in the workforce that is evident at many of our production facilities. And notwithstanding whatever we can do to reduce that turnover, we have to improve our training, our supervision, and our inspection. And in that latter aspect, we're going to have to offset some of the cutbacks that have occurred in the past in terms of Navy oversight and inspection. And that's something that we've already started doing, and we've established the budget to be able to build back in that regard. I will note, however, that every quality analysis that's ever been done that I have read or that I've been taught suggests that the hardest way to build quality in is by inspecting it at the end. You've got to start at the beginning. You've got to design the right way. You've got to build the right way. Now, there are a number of underlying factors here that are kind of sitting below the water, if you will, that in many aspects, I'm afraid, impact some of these corrective actions. We obviously have, particularly in the shipbuilding industry, very limited competition. Some people would suggest that there is no real competition, in part because so many of our products are yard-specific. And so it is more one of an allocation process than it really is a competition. And perhaps not surprisingly, given that limited competition, there's limited investment that goes on. And again, if one compares the investments that have taken place in U.S. shipyards compared to what one sees overseas in a wide variety of environments, one can see that we have fallen behind most of the world in terms of the technology that's been employed and the capabilities that exist at the shipyards. There is no motivation. The political process helps in that regard, and the priorities are very clear. In many aspects, by the way, this is nothing new. As I noted earlier on with the letters of marque, some of this dates back to the early days of our Navy, and I note that those of you who are familiar with the beginning of our Navy, I'll just remind you that the first six frigates were built at six different yards so as to provide the broadest possible political support, still somewhat in effect today. So what do we need to do to for the future? I would say, first and foremost, invest in the workforce. We have started to do that within Navy. We are building back much of the competencies, both in terms of acquisition, terms of systems engineering, terms of yard-specific inspection and support. And I hope to see the same basic approach employed by industry. We need to invest in facilities. And recognizing that it's going to be very difficult to create a truly competitive environment, we're going to have to incent contractors by way of profit incentives, perhaps more so than by way of competition. In other words, try to leverage the bottom line as opposed to the top line. We've had pretty good success, I'll suggest, in doing that on the Virginia submarine program with the CapEx program, where we've done some cost sharing on investment and sharing of the cost reductions with the contractors. And I think extending that concept is going to be particularly valuable in the future. Lastly, I think we need to hold those people involved, both the program officers within the Navy and the contractors, accountable for performance to our expectations. This cannot be a situation with entitlements. Everyone is not just entitled to continue in business and entitled to make a certain level of profit. That has to be earned. And there is both a carrot and a stick that needs to be provided here. And the Congress has got to enable us to do that. And to some extent, that too will be an interesting challenge. But with that, I'd be more than pleased to perhaps take some questions. I think I've gone Thank past you. My time here.
As is the norm here, please identify yourself and the organization that you represent, and a microphone will be delivered to you. I just want to begin by saying, as most of you know, there are two sides of the enterprise called the Department of Defense. There's the military operational intelligence policy NSC side, and then there's the business side. And as I indicated in my opening remarks, it's the three service secretaries who, with the Undersecretary for Acquisition and the Deputy Secretary, essentially manage that business side of the enterprise. And the Title 10 responsibilities of organizing, training, equipping, and constructing, it's really the equipping piece, in my view, is the single most important responsibility of a service secretary. Let me ask the first question. Mr. Secretary, you mentioned the advantages of the, I think, to date, four Virginia-class submarines. And I understand that the most recent one, 8 months ahead of schedule, reducing costs by $500 million per boat, even though it's built in two different shipyards, Electric Boat in Groton, Connecticut, and Newport News in Virginia. You mentioned several possible reasons why that particular shipbuilding program is considered one well managed, as opposed to the, as you know, you canceled the DDG 1000 and the troubled program littoral combat ship, the CVN 78, $1 billion in cost overruns. How do you distinguish between the ones that are not successful and the Virginia class submarine program?
Well, see, there are several aspects to the Virginia program that I think has provided it with a good basis of performance right now, not the least of which is the fact that it is a mature program. And one of the things that I think we consistently see is that it takes us a while to get new programs into a proper order. It is still taking us longer than we would like in terms of the number of ships that we have to go through in terms of the initial production runs before we're able to work out, if you will, the kinks. But I think also in the Virginia class, there's another advantage there, which is that the whole submarine community, and in particular the nuclear community, Navy nuclear program, has retained a very good technical authority and technical capability, which has enabled them to interact with a very technically motivated and fairly stable workforce at the yards that are responsible for the submarine production. There has been no competition in terms of attention. Virginia is the only submarine that's under production at this point in time in the U.S. inventory. And so all of the resources have been properly focused. I think there was also a recognition that the approach that has been specified in terms of the teaming relationship between Newport News and Electric Boat has provided an element of stability there. We've also been able to involve Quonset to provide some additional perspectives in different manufacturing approaches. And there has been a willingness on the part of both the contractors and the Navy, given the long run, production run, which provides a mechanism of establishing a business case for investment, to be able to identify both design changes and facility investments that have enabled us to affect some significant cost reductions there. That plus simply the stability of production, I think, has gone a long way to putting the Virginia program on a pretty good basis of operation. I would still love to see some further cost reductions in the program. I think that there are still issues that we need to address, and it is not totally free of quality concerns, although I think we've done a better job on that program than some others, perhaps just due to the very tight strictures imposed both by the Navy nuclear program and the subsafe requirements that are imposed on the submarine community.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Right here. Why don't you wait for the mic? And identify yourself, please.
Yeah. I'm Andrea Shalal, Lisa with Reuters. Nice to see you, Secretary Winder. Thank you for having this program. I have a couple of questions for you. One has to do with how you see now these difficult decisions that are being passed on to the next administration and whether you've prepared your own sort of recommendations and guidelines in terms of how they should proceed and in what order and what the top priorities are. Specifically, there's some discussion about a pretty big shortfall in the number of Hornets that you're going to have and whether you need to accelerate purchases of those airplanes in anticipation of, you know, before the F-35s are ready. And then I wanted to ask you to follow up on your remark about accountability, because certainly you've drawn the line and canceled contracts, but that we haven't seen heads rolling in terms of programs where there have been problems. And is that something that you think should have occurred on both the Navy and the industry side?
So two items there. Let me just try to address the first one in terms of preparing the next administration. Part of what I've been trying to do there is not so much to argue for specific approaches, but to more, I think, importantly, make sure that the next administration understands what we've done and why. What are the issues as we see them? What are the priorities as we have seen them? And why we have made certain decisions so that they understand the whys there, not just the specific facts and figures. And I think that the more that we can do to help them understand the rationale, I think the better off they'll be in a position to be able to take on those issues with whatever priorities and agendas that they have as an administration and deal with the matters in a timely manner. Relative to accountability, I think that at least within the Navy side, there has been very good accountability. And there have been a number of personnel that have been changed out. And I think that that is an unfortunate but necessary part of what needs to be done to ensure that people understand and recognize what is expected of them. And this is, if you will, part of the Navy culture. I have to tell you the number of times during my tenure that I've had to deal with retention or promotion matters relative to incidents at sea or at shore for a variety of factors. And I think that I can say that I think our Navy does a very good job of maintaining a consistent, albeit high, set of standards for their officers. and for their civilian personnel. And I think that that's something that we need to continue to do. And I wait to see the contractor community do the same. That's a matter that's still being evaluated as we go through the service life extension evaluation. And we still haven't completed that, and that's really a major item to factor into what needs to be done there in terms of TAC Air in a general sense. That plus watching the progress on the F-35 program, both in terms, obviously, of the carrier variant and the STOVL.
But do you think those concerns are overblown, or do you think?
I don't know how to say overblown or not. Again, these are the issues that we're looking at. These are the indicators that I want to take a look at, and those are the indicators that I will suggest to the next administration that they look at as they evaluate their needs.
Very good. Arno?
Honored to Borgrab, CSIS, Mr. Secretary. There were news reports today that a super tanker, Saudi flag, was hijacked by pirates off the Somalian coast. Do you have anything on that, and where do you think one should be going in terms of international cooperation to put an end to piracy?
Well, first of all, on that specific item, I have nothing further than what's been in the press that you've referred to. I think that this does need to be an international effort. I like to remind people that this is a very broad expanse, the area where piracy is being conducted. The coast of Somalia, for those of you who are not familiar with it, extends about 2,300 miles, so that it takes, quite frankly, a large presence, even with airborne support, to be able to guard those areas. We're trying to work with international partners to help establish areas where we can provide with other countries additional surveillance and support. And I think that by working together with them and also helping the commercial carriers understand what they can do to minimize the likelihood of being hijacked, the more that we can work all of this together, the more effective we will be.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Secretary, Otto Kreischer, Congress, Sea Power Magazine, Naval Forces Center. The DDG 1000 cancellation was meant to be a support of the Marine Corps forces and Army forces ashore. What's the road ahead on providing some form of support for our expeditionary forces when they do go ashore? Naval gunfires don't go very far and don't have that much accuracy.
Well, first of all, we have not canceled the program. We have continued the acquisition, and the plan is to buy a third DDG 1000. The future of the program, after we restart, we'd like to restart the DDG 51 line to be able to build back and be able to provide additional air and missile defense capabilities. And then the question, as you put it, is how best to support the Marines for any future amphibious operations. And in that regard, as you noted, naval surface fire support is limited in its range. We do have other capabilities on board, which includes surface-to-surface missile capability and also airborne support, as well as other options that we're looking at to provide additional surface fire support during landing operations. We recognize the requirement. The need to support the Marines is still there and is still evident. The question is, what is the most effective way to do that? And that's a matter that will continue to be evaluated, and I expect we'll take some additional work by the next administration.
In the back.
This is Steve Benson, CSIS. With regards to the boundaries that you were talking about as you move forward to the muzzle flash with private contractors, are you envisioning that the Navy may utilize private contractors further forward, let's say, into its combatant force or perhaps into the piracy situation where they operate on their own? Are you looking at new boundaries there?
I don't think we're looking at new boundaries. I hope you didn't take from my comments that I was pleased with the situation. I think, you know, again, if I can reiterate, when it comes to rear area support, major base operations and things of that nature, having contractor support for dining facilities, for sanitation purposes, laundry, things of that nature, provides an element of quality of life that I think is clearly valuable and cannot be provided any other way with an all-volunteer force, and in particular with the size of a force that we have right now. So I think that we're very comfortable with those aspects of it. Interpreter translators, other cultural domain informants, if you will, that is going to be a necessary part of any conflict, I'm afraid, for many years to come, unless future conflicts occur in areas where we have better language skills and better cultural understanding, an unlikely circumstance, I'll suggest. When it comes to technology infusion and the like, I'd like to keep it minimal. I don't like having Scan Eagle civilians out there in the forward operating bases. And I want to be able to bring that to an end, not because it's a bad program. It's doing a very, very good job. But I don't think it's appropriate to expose civilian contractor personnel to the risks associated with that type of a base operation. And I think it also creates a certain constraint on us, on our operations, to have to worry about and deal with the support to those personnel. So in the future, if anything, I'd like to minimize the activity, not expand it.
Yes, back here.
Hans Kaiser, CSIS. Mr. Secretary, once the F-18 production line will be shut down, the Navy, and especially the Marine Corps, will be reliant on one single producer for the for their tactical air fighters. How do you calculate the risk, and how do you figure in the risk of that into budgets, into future force plans? And what is the implication of having one sole provider for tactical aircraft on the strike fighter gap?
Well, we have one provider right now, if you will, for the Marine Corps. All the Stovalls are built. There's only one provider. There's only one product that's usable right now, and it's the Harrier. And sustaining them represents a significant risk. I think the real question is, can we ensure that the future F-35 Stovall provide us with the reliability and the maintainability that we need for operations on board? We've gone a long way to ensuring that our future amphibious carriers have the resources necessary to provide for the logistical support that we anticipate. And I think we need to work very hard with the contractor community to ensure that this is truly a quality product built, if you will, in a full quality culture. I'm hopeful that we're going to be able to do that, but the situation really is not going to be any different than it is right now for either the Marine Corps or for the carrier-based operations.
Okay. Mr. Secretary, you and I both discussed the excess capacity that exists in shipyards today, both in the naval shipyards, the four naval shipyards, and the, depending upon how you want to define it, six or seven privately owned shipyards. As you know, when Secretary Rumsfeld recommended the closure of Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, the BRAC Commission did not go along with that recommendation. Can you give us some insights as to what you think an approach to resizing our capability to build ships in this country? How should we undertake that?
Right now, we have six privately owned yards that produce the vast majority of our ships. And you can argue that that's a huge number, given the fact that we buy perhaps 6 to 10 ships in a year, which means you're producing typically a couple ships per year per yard. I can compare that to, say, Hyundai that builds about 70 a year. and is expanding, or at least was expanding prior to the economic stress of the last few months, was planning to expand to 100 a year production. It is obviously a very small, almost custom work type of an environment. That said, there are huge risks associated with going down to single producers. If you just go and take a look at what has transpired in the aftermath of Katrina down in the Gulf Coast, where, quite frankly, after 3 years post-Katrina, we still are having the impact at the shipyards of that event. Now, it's not due, by the way, to damage to the equipment or the facilities at the shipyards, but it is more due to the impact that it's had on the workforce. And by the way, this is something we've seen time and time again. You go back to the earthquake in Kobe, Japan, what it did there, even though all the factories were left undamaged, the workforce was devastated, and production on much of the microelectronics battery work that they did was impacted. Similar types of issues that we've had in the Gulf Coast. It's eventually working its way out, not without a lot of effort and impact. To expose ourselves to single point production and to expose ourselves to potential impact to those production facilities from natural disasters, from terrorist activities, or from an actual attack, I think has some significant ramifications. So it's a matter of working a balance, if you will. I think the perhaps the overriding consideration is, again, the political one. And to some extent, I have to admit that I haven't spent much time or effort trying to think of how I would like to arrange the shipbuilding activity, recognizing that there are only certain things that can be done within the current political environment, and I'm not sure that much can be done to adjust the shipbuilding manufacturing base at this point in time. So it's not something I've really worried about.
Maybe your successor or your successor's successor.
We'll see.
Any final questions? Yes, right here.
Mike Seifert from Honeywell. Mr. Secretary, my question concerns communications between industry and government. How do you help encourage better communications in advance of procurement so that industry can provide feedback on requirements and be able to help not necessarily shape them, but better help the military understand the cost implication on certain requirements, and that would help maybe drive costs down overall on some of these procurements?
Well, I think there's two aspects I would like to touch on in that regard, one of which is developing more skilled requirements personnel within the Navy. I think that that's an issue that needs to be worked on and is something that's been recognized, and I've had a number of discussions on that matter with CNO and other personnel within the department, and I think we're going to try to establish more of a formal training program there to be able to professionalize that aspect of the process. One of the things I've tried very hard to do in the way that we've restructured the whole acquisition process within the department is to force the senior military personnel up to the CNO and the commandant to be more involved in the whole requirements process so that they're part of the program definition and they understand the implications of what they're asking for and what they're willing to compromise on. And I think the more that we can do that, the more that we can get them directly engaged, the better off we will be in terms of providing products that really reflect their needs and their priorities. The other aspect, I think, if I can just make a point here for more of the political environment, we've got to make it easier for people to go from industry into the government. And I'm very concerned that we're right now perhaps moving in the wrong direction with additional conflict of interest measures, making it difficult for people with current industrial experience to go into industry. Right now, industry knows very well how the department operates. because simply industry hires most of the department alumni, or at least a significant fraction of the personnel from the military services, and so that they have a very good understanding of the department. Department doesn't have a good view of industry. There are very few people who have gone from industry into either civilian or even fewer uniformed service within the military. We need to be able to open that up. We need to be able to encourage more of that. We need to be able to develop an understanding within the department of what it is that industry does and how they do it, so as to facilitate that conversation.
All right. I just want to emphasize on behalf of CSIS our pleasure and honor to have you here. The Secretary made the comment there at the end, how does the President of the United States attract the most capable, the most experienced individuals to those tough jobs of the Department of Defense? The myth that the revolving door is a negative is just that, in my opinion. Individuals who know the buy and sell side of the enterprise are the kinds of individuals who are the best suited, it seems to me, to serve in these positions. So again, Mr. Secretary, thank you very much.